This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in Your Health and this Monday, we continue NPR's Living Large series. We look at fat and why it's so hard to keep off. We're in the second decade of an obesity epidemic, and it's still going strong.
The reasons range from bad eating habits to a sedentary lifestyle, something we all know. Then there are genetics and biology, and it turns out your fat cells work against you. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
If you're among the two-thirds of Americans who are overweight, chances are you've had people tell you to just use some self-control and stop eating so much. It does boil down to calories in, calories out. But as obesity specialist Dr. Donna Ryan says, it's really much more complicated than that.
It's really when you start to try to lose that the biology really kicks in and tries to resist the weight loss.
And that's part of what creates the frustration many of us feel, gaining, losing, and gaining again. For Mary Grant, who's 56 years old, trying to lose weight has been part of her life since childhood. It started when her father called her fat, told her no one would date a fat girl, and embarrassed her in front of the entire family.
On the back of the door was my weight chart, and the scale stood in the kitchen. So every Saturday morning, first thing before anything else happened, I got weighed in front of everybody.
During teenage years, Grant's father put her on diet after diet after diet.
I did the have a half a grapefruit before every meal diet. I did the early days of Weight Watchers when you had to eat chicken livers. I did the tomato soup diet, the cabbage soup diet, you know, anything to get that weight off of me.
Grant never did lose weight. She entered nursing school overweight, but soon after, she did a medically supervised fasting diet and lost a dramatic 100 pounds.
I did it the same year Oprah did it. The day she showed up on her TV show in her size 10 jeans was the day I fit into my size 10 jeans. I remember it exactly.
Grant kept the weight off for 6 years, but then she started to gain again. She never got as heavy as she'd been, but still, she was overweight.
Do you think it's easy to lose weight?
Yes.
Oh, we got some yeses. Let's
20 take, overweight people sit around Dr. Donna Ryan at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They're part of a study looking at how weight loss affects obesity-related health problems like heart disease and diabetes.
How many of you think it's easy to keep that lost weight off?
No.
Does there anybody who thinks it's easy to keep it off? No, it's not easy to keep it off.
And this is the heart of the matter. It's one thing to lose weight. It's another altogether to keep it off. And Ryan says this is where the biology takes over.
There's a hormone that's called leptin. It's produced by your fat cells. When levels of it drop, it sends signals to your brain that your fat cells are reducing, that the amount of fat in your body is reducing.
And then other biological signals get going. The brain basically perceives having less food as starvation, so the body shifts into automatic and begins to fight back. The brain tells the body, conserve energy. Metabolism drops, and here's the worst part, brain chemicals send messages to the body that it's hungry, really hungry.
So there are lots of brain peptides, brain hormones that kick in, that stimulate appetite, and that drive you to be more hungry and to seek more food. It's the body's biology resisting your attempts to achieve a negative energy balance and to lose weight that really create the problems.
So add hormones that stimulate appetite to hormones that decrease metabolism, and you have a double whammy stacked against your efforts to lose weight. Just ask Mary Grant.
My feeling is that my cells have memories, and when they're thin and not full of fat, they're just not happy.
Unhappy fat cells? Well, says Dr. Ryan, that's pretty much on target.
The reduced person has to eat fewer calories to maintain that weight as compared to a person who's exactly the same weight but is not reduced.
Say you weigh 230 pounds. You lose 30 pounds. You're down to 200. Your friend is also 200 pounds and has always been 200 pounds. You have to eat less than your friend to maintain the very same weight.
Well, hi, Linda.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm just really disappointed that I've gained weight again lately. And
What do you think happened?
At the Greenfield Health Clinic in Portland, Oregon, Dr. Cynthia Ferrier talks with her patient, 61-year-old Linda Tufel. Last year, Tufel lost 100 pounds, but now she's devastated that she's gained it back.
325 pounds. And I was down last year, last fall, to 235.
And here's the real rub. The more weight you lose, the more difficult it is to maintain the weight loss. So the biggest losers have the hardest time. For people like Linda Tufel, metabolism grinds down lower and lower as more and more pounds come off. And going to the doctor often becomes a dismal chore.
Because it's just too hard for me to keep coming in and, you know, gaining. Once I start losing, I'll come in again.
You could think of it this way, says Dr. Ryan. Overweight people have a caloric handicap. Depending on how much weight they've lost, they have to eat 300, 400, or even 500 calories less every day if they want to continue losing. And Ryan says, as far as we know, it appears this lower metabolism lasts a lifetime.
Once you've gained the weight, you can never go back to your old habits and expect that the weight is going to stay off, because it'll go right back to where it was.
Before you get too demoralized, the fact is you can fight back. For starters, you have to figure out a good, healthy diet you can be on for the rest of your life. No more grapefruit or cabbage soup diets. You're unlikely to stay on those forever. You can also kick up your metabolism. You just have to do it every day. Take the findings of this study, says Ryan, that looked at people who were successful in keeping their weight down over a number of years.
For the men and women in that study, their usual physical activity is about 1 hour of moderate physical activity 6 days a week. It's expending about 450 or so calories a day.
A bonus to help battle that lower metabolism. And the hour of physical activity doesn't have to be vigorous like jogging. It can be moderate like brisk walking, swimming, or biking. Research now shows that even modest weight loss can make a big difference in health. In Dr. Ryan's study, the average participant lost only 5% of their initial weight, but their blood sugar and cholesterol went down, and many people were able to get off diabetes and blood pressure medications.
So this modest weight loss that they've achieved has really translated into substantial benefits.
Is the FedEx guy coming? Oh, she does not like the FedEx.
At home, Mary Grant's dogs, Coco and Bandit, help her stay active. She knows well she has to remain vigilant if she's to lose that last 20 pounds.
And I'll do it. My husband always says, you know, you put your mind to it, you can do it. The important thing is not to beat yourself up. We spend way too much time doing that. I weigh once a week. You know, I keep a food diary. I do all the things I know I'm supposed to do.
And if her weight climbs, Grant knows she has to cut back on what she's eating and increase her exercise. Federal health officials recommend 30 minutes a day of moderate exercise to reduce the risk of heart disease. But you need twice that amount, an hour a day, if you want to lose or maintain weight loss. Patty Namond, NPR News.
Let's turn now to a class action lawsuit in Miami filed by college students who say they shouldn't be charged out-of-state tuition because they live in Florida and are American citizens. They were born, however, to illegal immigrants. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami that the students say Florida's regulations violate their constitutional rights.
Wendy Ruiz is a 19-year-old with a plan.
Since, like, I was a little girl, I wanted to be a podiatrist.
She's now a sophomore at Miami-Dade College with a 3.7 grade point average. She expects to graduate later this year with a 2 years associate's degree in biology. Ruiz is paying three times what most other students pay for tuition at Miami-Dade College. When she enrolled last year, she was told that because her parents lack legal immigration papers, she has to pay out-of-state tuition rates, nearly $5,000 per semester. She's been able to pay that by working multiple jobs and with help from her parents. But next year, she hopes to enroll at a more expensive state school, Florida International University.
And in FIU, I would have to pay like around almost $18,000 out of state. I can't afford that. So that's why I was like, I need to speak up because I can't pay for this amount of money, you know? And I should be in state, not out of state.
As a good student, Ruiz qualifies for scholarships. Paying out-of-state tuition rates may slow her down, but she expects eventually to fulfill her dream of becoming a podiatrist. But she feels that Florida is not giving her a fair shake.
I was born and raised in Miami, Florida. I'm in-state, not out-of-state. It's really unfair. Many students, actually, that are being charged out-of-state, they're not going to school because of how much money.
Ruiz is one of five students, all U.S.-born and children of illegal immigrants, who are suing the state, claiming their rights as citizens are being violated. It's difficult to say how many students in Florida fall into this category. The state law has been in effect now for just a few years, and certainly hundreds of Floridians, at least, are potentially affected. This is not about the DREAM Act. Florida, like many states and Congress, has considered a law to extend in-state tuition rates to residents who are not citizens but were brought to the U.S. at a young age by their parents. Tanya Galone with the Southern Poverty Law Center in Miami says unlike the DREAM Act, the principles in this case should be less controversial.
We're talking about students, all of whom are United States citizens. And I think that this is something that people can come together on, that when you're a U.S. citizen, you're a U.S. citizen. You have the same rights, the same obligations as any other U.S. citizen. We don't create subclasses of American citizens in the United States. So once you have citizenship, you deserve to be treated equally.
It's an issue that's come up in some other states. Both California and Colorado resolved similar disputes by extending in-state tuition rates to the students in question. In Florida, the policy is the result not of a law, but regulations handed down by the State Education Department and the Board of Governors, which oversees higher education. Neither body is commenting on the lawsuit, but it's possible Florida lawmakers may take matters into their own hands. State Representative Reggie Fullwood, a Democrat, introduced a bill that would extend in-state tuition to citizens raised in Florida, regardless of their parents' immigration status. But he says it's possible the problem could be fixed if the education commissioner and the governor decide to rewrite the regulations.
You know, I would be extremely happy if we didn't have to push this legislation, if there was some, you know, policy fix or some, you know, administrative fix that can be done. So I would, you know, I would be one of the happiest people around.
That's also something Miami-Dade college student Wendy Ruiz is hoping for, a speedy rules change that would make college affordable and enable her to get on with her plans for a career in podiatry. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Here are some truths that are not entirely self-evident. On September 18, 2012, the people of Madison, Wisconsin will take a vow of no cannibalism. It will last 7 days. In Korea, it is common to give glass figurines, especially figurines of Vincent D'Onofrio, the Koreans' favorite actor. And when SCUBA does not stand for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing American, it stands for Southern Cuba Uncommunist Business Association. How do I know these strange facts, so unsettling to conventional wisdom, and in fact so completely bogus? I have read them all in John Hodgman's new book, the third and logically the final book in his trilogy of encyclopedic wisdom. The title is That Is All. John Hodgman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak with you, my old nemesis.
And I should remind listeners that in addition to appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as a general expert on just about everything, you were also the person in a long-running but now long-gone series of Apple commercials in which you played the competition, the personal computer. I gather this was a life-changing experience for you.
It was indeed. People would come up to me and say, hey, personal computer, will you print out this document for me? They would say, hey, will you correct the red eye in this photograph of me? And they don't ask me to do that anymore, even though I'm really good at it.
What has it been like to fall back to earth from this pinnacle of fame you enjoyed?
Well, it's a mournful experience, quite honestly. I mean, those ads were not only a lot of fun for me to make, but also it marked a huge transformation in my life from basically magazine writer and literary humorist, you know, your basic nobody, to a very famous minor television personality. And while I understand that all things must come to an end, whether it's a television advertisement or one's life or the world itself, it doesn't make it any easier to deal with our own mortality.
Speaking of the end of the world itself, your book, That Is All, it's a very unusual book. It begins on page 607 because the trilogy, I gather, is a single work.
Yes.
It is amply footnoted, and it also includes at the top of each page a day-by-day calendar entry for the coming year that breathes a vivid, detailed life into the Mayan forecast of the end of time.
Well, as you know, this is the year 2011, and if you own a calendar, you'll know that it's just one scant year before 2012. And if you own a Mayan long count calendar, then I suspect your home is very large because those things are big and made of stone. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Mayans stopped making calendars because they thought 2012 was going to be the end of the world. And due to some visions that I had at night under the influence of my albuterol asthma inhaler, I saw some difficult things coming down the line.
I think difficult things is an understatement. Giant toads, mole men heading to the center of the Earth.
Yes. You speak of the century toad that exists at the center of the Earth. And, of course, the return of the ancient unspeakable ones, like H.P. Lovecraft predicted. There's the blood wave, the Omega Pulse, and also the collapse of the American book publishing industry.
I don't mean to make
which
light
for some
of that,
people yes. is truly the end of the world, especially those of us who only have books to write.
Yes, you in this book, just as in the first in the trilogy, The Areas of My Expertise, I believe you had 500 hobo names.
700. Actually. Please don't understate.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to deny you credit.
My writing of 700 ridiculous hobo nicknames.
And now you have hundreds of names of the unspeakable ones.
Who 700 ancient and unspeakable gods. The ancient gods who are known for their wrath, their cosmic indifference to humanity, their tentacles, and who will soon return to the Earth and make it their plaything once more.
One of the dimensions of this coming apocalypse is what you write about is the jock-nerd convergence.
Oh, this is very disturbing, isn't it?
Yes.
The fight between jock culture and nerd culture is the culture war of our time. I mean, that really, I think almost everything in life can be divided into whether it represents a jockish view of the world, which is to say authoritarian, top-down, privileging gut instinct over rumination and the hatred of anyone who uses the word rumination, and the nerd point of view, which is obsessive enthusiasm for increasingly marginal niche cultures and subcultures and a kind of joyful utopian anarchy. And yet there is so much overlap that's happening now. Now, superhero movies are apparently the only movies that are made. I read of an actual bases ball player who has named his bases ball bat after Orcrist, which is one of the elven blades in The Hobbit.
Among many other surprising facts in your book, such as how Harry Houdini escaped from a can of sardines and how
trapdoor.
The sardines were made. Yeah, trapdoor.
Spoiler alert, trapdoor.
The sardines cooperated, though, with this.
As much as sardines can. They were drugged.
You also offer some useful tips on traveling around the world, which I gather that you've come by in your recent career as a deranged millionaire.
Yes. Well, now that my commercials are over, presumably because we sold all the computers, I lead a simpler life of a humble, deranged millionaire. And I've traveled all over the world to, gosh, I would say three continents, at least four provinces of Canada, most of the United States, and on cruise ships. And this is the most fascinating thing, because a cruise ship is like a fantastic floating city. And when the blood wave comes, you'll want to be on one.
When the blood wave comes, yes.
I don't
rather than being on land, you're saying.
Oh, yes. I would say either when the seas rise or the blood wave comes, you will want to be on one of these gigantic cruise ships. It's one of the ways that you can survive for just a few days longer. But let me tell you, traveling on the sea, there's a lot of superstition around it. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I do now after reading your book, but you should share with the listeners.
Yes, I was setting myself up for that one, if you don't mind. Yes. Did you know that a woman on board is considered to be bad luck? And that's why obviously we let
a lot of bad luck in the world.
Yeah, we let women on board cruise ships, but they are asked to wear special rayon underwear because it is believed that vengeful Poseidon can't see through rayon. So, and dolphins swimming alongside a ship's bow are considered good luck. So when you're on a cruise ship, please don't free the dolphins that have been lashed to the front of the ship, even if it seems they're just being dragged along. It may look like they're suffering, but they're just lazy. Dolphins are incredibly lazy, as you know.
Well, now we know. And
yes.
You've made sailing that much more user-friendly, I guess, to use it.
Yes, and I wish to emphasize that while my book does deal with the coming global superpocalypse known as Ragnarok, it's not depressing. And indeed, there's much, much more in this book about travel and sports and wine and magic tricks and ghosts and anything that might distract a casual reader from the fact that they are mortal, which is everyone.
Well, John Hodgman, thank you very much for talking with us.
I could be wrong, you know.
Let's hope.
It may be that the world will not end on December 21st, 2012.
Okay.
In which case, you can buy the paperback.
John Hodgman's book is called That Is All. Is it really the last of your encyclopedic works? Or?
It certainly is the last of my books of complete world knowledge. This is final world knowledge, at last, finally complete.
Are you saying you're now going to get speculative?
I think I'm going to take a rest.
Our program is directed by Brendan Banizak, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Dennis Herndon. Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Abby Sykes, Franklin Cater, Justine Kennan, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Viet Le, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, and Rhonda Ray. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin, and I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And today, in honor of Halloween, you get to hear one of our reporters as you have never heard her before. That is NPR's Netta Ulaby at a haunted house in Los Angeles. Actually, it's more than just a haunted house. It is a scary play in a vacant old home, complete with the kind of special effects you could only find in the show business capital of the world.
The setting is a real decaying old white mansion with broken windows and cracked columns near downtown. Quite a few horror films have been shot right here. The mansion's rotting interior was fitted out with wires by stuntman John Braver, and he roped in friends who designed stunts for movies like Mission Impossible 4.
It was so perfect. I was like, oh, wait a minute. I have access to some of the best stunt people in the business. Why not bring them in and ask them to cut their rate?
Braver put his entire life savings into creating this interactive play called Delusion. The house is supposed to be an insane asylum in the early 1900s. All the inmates are cursed with paranormal powers. Women with wild eyes and hanging hair crawl upside down on the ceiling, wailing. And the doomed doctor who was your guide gets dragged down a hallway by an invisible hand.
No, no, no.
Abandoning you halfway through the tour. But the scariest thing is when they reach out and grab you. It's so basic. But it works.
It's actively scary.
That's actor Neil Patrick Harris, about to go through the play for the second time. As a magician, he respects the show's elaborately rigged scares and stunts. But the most terrifying moment for him was low-tech. It came when he was sitting at a creepy Victorian dining room table and was then unable to stand.
The hands were holding me down and forcing me to stay seated. I couldn't get up. I think I reverted to, like, my 8-year-old self.
Delusion was developed by stuntman John Braver after he became disillusioned with traditional haunted houses.
It's a maze. Let's get the next person in. Let's just make our money and jump out and scare, simple little scares. And it's the same old thing, same old tactics.
Braver wanted deeper scares driven by psychology. He disdains guts and gore. Delusion's story is gothic and twisted, involving science gone badly awry.
What is happening? Oh my God, what is that?
That is a creeping mutant doll girl headed for our ankles.
Oh my God!
The characters are not just freaks, but unstable heroes, evil doctors, and helpful hosts who treacherously turn on the visitors. Like when my group gets herded into a tiny wood-slatted space, supposedly for our own safety.
Oh, she's locking the door.
What's happening?
Our host, I think, just got murdered. We're trapped in a cage.
Extreme reactions, says Braver, are part of the process.
We had one girl, she froze. Narrator had to literally go back in the room and grab her and pull her into the next room. That's success. I think if you can get somebody to freeze or pee, then success.
Delusions found success in other ways. It sold more than 25,000 tickets in less than a week, and those tickets run $40 a pop. Braver would love to tailor other haunted plays to spooky old buildings all over the world. Maybe even start a haunted play franchise. For now, he hopes this is the start of a Halloween tradition.
I mean, every year I'd like to just do Haunted Play Presents Delusion, Haunted Play Presents Castration. That would be a horrible play. I would not go to that play. I recommend you stay away from that.
Remember, he's not really into gore. He likes psychological terror. So Braver would have been pleased when one visitor, 29-year-old Andrea Hadel, completely freaked out after leaving the mansion at the end and could not find her friend.
They still have Lisa! Where's Lisa? Wait, they still have her! Oh, there she is.
Lisa made it out. This time. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
People across the Northeast are still huddling under blankets and lighting their houses with candles. Power remains out for more than 2 million homes and businesses, and it may be several days before they get light and heat back. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, the rare October storm has prompted the cancellation of everything from school to Halloween.
This was not the kind of spooky Halloween anybody here had in mind.
No, not at all.
Nancy and Curtis Farrar of Framingham decked their house with spooky lights, cobwebs, and assorted creepy creatures that were supposed to growl at trick-or-treaters.
The house is all decorated. Can't plug it in, though.
Instead, they and others who lost power, like Donna Johnson from Lincoln, got more than their share of spooky just by going to bed in a cold, dark house where they could hear things going bump in the night.
You can hear these things sound like gunshots, and it's tree limbs breaking off. Or trees falling down.
One after another.
Right.
Spookier than it usually is.
6-year-old Matthew Mead is one of thousands delighted by the unexpected snow day from school. He came to the Home Depot with his dad to get fireplace tools. Others rushed the store for generators, flashlights, chainsaws, and firewood. The Farrars went to 3 stores looking for logs to burn.
Trying to light a fire.
It's about 55 in my house right now.
2 logs, huh?
That's it. I was hoping for more, but I'm going to get some more wood right now.
This Home Depot in Waltham, Massachusetts, is also without power. Cash registers and a few lights are working off a generator, and employees like Delphine Bournique were escorting customers through the aisles.
When it's pitch dark outside, you don't see a lot in the store. It's very dark. So we're helping customers with flashlights.
And no one knows how long until power lines will be fixed. Except for snowplows pushing the foot and a half of snow that fell in Amherst, Massachusetts, the usually busy town center was more like a ghost town today. A small crowd gathered at one business that managed to open, David Woodward Henyon's coffee shop, where he started the day boiling water on his gas stoves to make coffee the old-fashioned way.
No, there was no power here. We worked by flashlight, but the power's on now.
For others, however, officials say it may be a while. An unprecedented number of crews from as far as Texas and Michigan are helping in Massachusetts, but they're needed all over the Northeast, from New Jersey to New York, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. Trees bigger than you could even get your arms around are lying on their signs in New York Central Park. And in New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie says many roads are still impassable, not so much because of the amount of snow, but because of the way it's stuck to trees that still have leaves.
Leaves on the trees have made whole trees and huge branches come down, take down more wires. There are more lines down than there were during Hurricane Irene. And so this was an extraordinarily bizarre storm.
How are you today? Good?
I'm fine. How are you?
Did you lose the power over your house?
We did.
Same with me. Well, mine's still not on.
Back at the Home Depot in Waltham, Massachusetts, even the hardiest New Englanders are a little rattled by this nor'easter. We've all built snowmen before, just not usually with freshly carved pumpkins for heads. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From bankruptcy now to startup, The economy's slow pace of job creation has revived interest in getting new technologies out of university labs and into the marketplace. Stanford University is taking the lead. A group of academic researchers from all over the country has gathered there. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, they're getting a crash course in how to turn their projects into startup companies.
Steve Blank is passionate about the entrepreneurship course he teaches at Stanford. And to instill enthusiasm for the startup and offer a taste of the potential financial rewards, he's invited the academics about to take his class to a spectacular ranch on the California coast. Standing on the second floor landing above the crowd, he tells the researchers, "You're in entrepreneurial boot camp. You need to be smart, focused, and eager." He bounds down the stairs, urging them to be first to show off their stuff. Each of the 21 teams has its own project. Things like terahertz electronics, new technology for detecting explosives, a smarter device for delivering pain medication. The National Science Foundation, which screened the applicants and awarded each team $50,000, has a history of funding basic research. But its efforts to get cutting-edge technology out of the lab and into the market have been relatively modest.
What do you do if you want to get more startups, more technology transferred out of the university? You need to sort of bootstrap. You need to start that culture up from scratch.
That's Jacob Schmidt. He's a researcher at UCLA, and he's taking the class.
Part of this program, hopefully, can train a bunch of scientists and engineers to think like entrepreneurs, to go back and then sort of spread the word.
So what are they learning? Bullet point number one.
Startups are not smaller versions of large companies.
Steve Blank adds the emphasis on management and execution. Things taught in traditional MBA programs can come later. Another point, it's okay to take risks and fail, as long as you learn from your mistakes.
You know what we call a failed entrepreneur in Silicon Valley? Experienced. It's a huge idea.
Blank, a very successful serial entrepreneur, then poses two questions for the students to answer. What is their business model, and how will they test it?
The most efficient way to teach this is to treat everything you think you know about building a business as nothing more than a hypothesis. Hypothesis.
So he sends the academic teams out of the building and often out of their comfort zones to contact potential customers face-to-face. And what many quickly discover is they may have to rethink parts of their strategy.
Our initial view of who we thought the customers were was a bit flawed.
Ellis Ming's team from the University of Southern California is working on a new implantable device for drug delivery. Her team's happy to be part of this program.
I think the value to us is the focus and then finding the new information. I think we were actually pretty far along when we came in, but we're now even further and better for that.
I think we can be a $1 billion company in maybe 10 years.
Jorge Herod, an engineer who took Blank's class at Stanford earlier this year, is a big believer in the instructor's approach. He originally thought of building a grass-clipping robot, but discovered a large untapped market for a weed cutter for organic farms. Blue River Technology was launched and has already received outside funding, hired an employee, and plans to hire several more.
I feel I'm prepared, I'm having successes. It's feeling really, really right.
But whether large numbers of researchers who've spent most of their professional lives in academic labs will be able to start companies is far from certain. Still, venture capitalist John Fiber, who's been part of the teaching team, thinks the government's investment will pay off.
If we look at the core strength of the United States over a long period of time, it's great universities, it's funded research, and it's what comes out of that commercially that employs people and creates great businesses. So that's the long-term strategic opportunity for us as a country.
The number of startups likely to emerge from this group of students is small, but Stanford's Steve Blank predicts the course will change how the researchers think. I sit in the back of the room, he says, and smile because we planted something that will never disappear. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.